I'm Humphrey Hawksley, and thank you for joining the Magazine Show podcast brought to you by Golster, the experts in health and well-being, with a range of fascinating guests who stimulate, educate, and make us laugh. Hello and welcome. I am Humphrey Hawksley, and this is the Golster Magazine Show, which brings you fascinating, fabulous, and compelling guests with stories to tell and tips of how to navigate our way in the world. And with me today is a man whose face and voice are known to millions as his work as a sports writer. And we're going to be talking about all of that, but I'm also intrigued in his own life, the struggles, the adaptations needed, the drive that led to abandoning a palatial, comfortable and servant-laden life in India to join the grit and bleakness of 1970s Britain, and then fight his way to the top of a career that he loved. How do we do that? What is that inner self that makes us do something like that? Welcome, Mihir Bose, to the Golster Magazine Show.
Well, thank you very much, Humphrey. It's an absolute pleasure talking to you from my loft here in Shepherd's Bush, a world removed from Mumbai, where I grew up.
Now, Shepherd's Bush, that's about as gritty as they come in London, isn't it?
Yes, I remember one of the sitcoms the BBC had when I came here about Shepherd's Bush, and, you know, it was very, very funny. I wasn't familiar with the world because I thought all of England looked like the inside of Buckingham Palace.
And the book that you've written, many books, but I particularly want to talk about your latest one called Thank You, Mr. Crombie, Lessons in Guilt and Gratitude to the British, and it shows a young man walking across, which is now a familiar sort of newsagent thing, but in 1970s Britain. Who is Mr. Crombie?
Mr. Crombie was a Home Office official who, to my great surprise, wrote to me in 1975 when, having qualified as a chartered accountant, I was being the good Indian boy and going back to become a partner in an accountancy firm. Sheer nepotism, may I say, Humphrey, because the senior partner was my brother-in-law. And he wrote to me saying, you have now got indefinite leave to remain in this country, which sounded a bit like little Johnny had been allowed to sleep over. I didn't even know you could get indefinite leave because I used to be on a student visa, which I renewed every year. And that meant that if I left the country and came back after 2 years, I had the right to enter the country. And when a few years later, I renewed that two-year thing, and when a few years later I decided that I really wanted to become a journalist and try and emulate my heroes, James Cameron and Neville Carter's, not that I have, I gave up accountancy and came back to this country, and the immigration officer had to finally let me in because I had the right to remain here.
And that, because now in the day that we work, you never actually really have a name or talk to anybody, but you made a point that you knew his name, but also he hand wrote you the letter.
Absolutely, and that's the sort of thing that my father would have been very impressed with, because my father got me to write on these scripts, make sure that my handwriting was good. If you saw my handwriting now, you would think it's worse than a doctor's prescription. But and it was very touching that he wrote my name with his own hand, and he wrote his name. And that is why I know Mr. Crombie, and I don't know where he is. I'd love to meet him. He's just, I think, at Home Office. He was a Home Office official. And now, of course, you would get an email letter which you wouldn't know who sent it, except it had been sent by some officer in some office.
It probably been sent by an algorithm or a robot or something. But did you write and thank him, or did you have you seen him? Did you have any correspondence after that?
No, I just put the letter away thinking what a piece of gold dust I'd got, preserved it very, very carefully, always kept it next to me. I never tried to contact him. I thought, how would I contact him at the Home Office? It's only when I came to write this book, I thought I should give him a letter of thanks to express my appreciation. Also because nowadays, of course, people talk so much more about immigration. Immigration has always been a topic in this country, as far as I can recall, but, you know, boat people coming and so on and so forth. So I wanted to show that there was a human touch in the Home Office. It wasn't absolutely an inhuman machine that treated people badly.
Yes. Now, I want to talk about your family in a moment back in India, but why were you here? Why did you come here?
Well, the India I grew up in, it was considered that you were not really qualified unless you got a British qualification. That was the final imprint on your education. For instance, our degree, and I got a degree in India in physics and maths, that degree was considered by the British universities to be equivalent to A-level. So I came here to become an engineer. And the reason I came here to become an engineer, though I have no aptitude for engineering, as my schoolmaster in Mumbai told me at the time, is because Nehru, India's first prime minister, wanted to industrialize India. He had abandoned Gandhi's idea of going back to pre-industrial village life. And if you were good at studies, which basically, Humphreys, meant not that you were intelligent, that you passed the exam, which is a totally different thing to actually knowing the subject, as we all know. That means you mugged up the right things and answered them in a three-hour exam. Anyway, you were pushed into engineering. The women, I might say, were pushed into arts, so that their BA degrees would get them good husbands. In our case, it was a case of becoming engineers and then coming back and building the steel mills and the industrial plants, which now, of course, we look down on as considered the symbols of success.
So you were, what, in your sort of early 20s, are we talking about?
21, just had my 21st birthday. And here there's an interesting point. Most of my friends went to America, and the reason for that was America, hard to believe, in those days, America until the 60s kept out Asians from emigrating to America, and America had opened up emigration to all over the world, and most of my school friends, many of whom went abroad, have actually settled in America, and believe it or not, they are absolutely virulent Trump supporters, but that's
we'll bring you back and we can discuss all that. But that's interesting. But you're 21 years old. You're here in Britain. You've got this letter saying that changes your life.
The letter came in 75 when I was leaving the country.
Okay. But in this era, in your early, I mean, what is it? You trained to be an accountant. You then became an engineer, but you actually wanted to become a writer. How did that all mesh together?
I trained to be an engineer, and then I became an accountant. And I became an accountant for the simple reason that my father had said, there's no money in journalism. He was completely right. And I thought, if I qualified as an accountant, and when I try to become a journalist, if I can't get a job, I won't starve. I will always earn some money as an accountant. That was a fail-safe mechanism, if you like, my fallback position. So though I hated accountancy, but I managed to pass the exams and so on. You can always pass exams by going to tutorial classes and so on, as I found in my life. And I wanted to become a journalist. In those days, in this country, there were no journalism courses. People became journalists by joining their local paper. And of course, that avenue was not open to me. There was only one course of journalism, which had started in Cardiff. And Cardiff rejected me. When I went for the interview, I babbled away about all the great British journalists I had read and admired and so on. They thought I was not Bose, but I was Verbose, and they didn't offer me on the course. They didn't accept me on the course, and so I then had to find a way of getting into journalism.
And what was that way? You knocked on the door.
Yes, what happened was in 1974, I qualified as a chartered accountant. I was working for an accountancy firm, earning for the first time good money. I could even take my girlfriend to the Savoy. And the summer, the cricket season was about to start. The Indians were coming to tour, and India had beaten England for the first time 3 years earlier. They had beaten England in England and in India. And I rang up LBC, London Broadcasting, which had just started as a commercial radio. And I rang up the sports editor, I remember from a coin box telephone in Fleet Street, and I said, I know everything about cricket, I know everything about India, and so on and so forth, and I think I would become a wonderful cricket correspondent for you. And he said, fine, on Saturday the Indians are playing Hampshire at Southampton, off you go and report. And I used to, in my bed sit, try and imitate John Arlott, you see, sit there in my lonely bed sit in Clapham, and imagine I was at a test match. So I tried to do it. In fact, John Arlott was in the press box there at Southampton, which for me was like meeting God. And I did a few radio broadcasts. It was just a news broadcast as to what was happening and so on. And and at the end of it, the sports editor said, yes, off you go to Bradford. The Indians are playing Yorkshire. So I was, except my name was a problem. And initially, LBC called me Richard Rose, not Mir Bose. So, you know.
Okay. So, Richard Grove, I'll call you that for the next week. So, let's park that there. Let's go back to India, where you were. I mean, you trained to be an accountant. You said that you should go back there as a good Indian to become part of the company, but you didn't. Was that seen as an act of rebellion?
It was seen as a great act of rebellion. I was a partner there. I had all the comforts of a partnership, a car, servants. I'm sorry, this sounds very feudal, but that's the way it was. Membership of clubs. These were clubs that the British had set up, which Indians hadn't been allowed then, but now the Indians had taken over, and, you know, things like that and all that sort of thing, and a great deal of comfort in life. And I suddenly decided that if I didn't make this break, I would always feel, why didn't I do it? I would be very comfortable. And looking back, I think that if I had stayed there, I would have become senior partner. I would have retired by now. And getting on a plane, I would have always turned left, because I would have been traveling first class and not right on the economy class. But I don't regret that for a moment, though I know it broke my father's heart and my mother's heart. And sad to say, I wasn't in India when my father died, and I feel very bad about it. And I still to this day feel that there I was, busy writing, covering stories, which the light of the day really don't mean anything, you know, looking back.
And was that, and your siblings, did you have siblings or that were saying you should come back and you were the black sheep, or how did that all fit together?
No, my siblings were very kind. In fact, my elder sister, whose husband had given me the job, never really took me to task. And I got on very well with him. I still get on very well with him. He's still alive. They live in India. And my other sister went to live in Toronto, married in Toronto, and she was very kind. I think they didn't say anything to me, but my mother felt very hurt. And towards the end of my father's life, when she was looking after my father on her own, she wept tears which were very sad. And looking back, I do feel that I didn't behave like a good son, let alone a good Indian son.
So you don't feel there wasn't sort of complete reconciliation and understanding there? There was unfinished business, as it were?
Yeah, my father never took me to task, but yes, I felt deep down he was hurt, and this came over, not so much in what he said, but in sometimes his gestures and the way he behaved, if you like.
And you say in the book, you talk about a Downton Abbey type of experience, if you want us to imagine what it was like for you then. Has Indian society broken down a bit since then, as British society did, or do they still have these huge palatial places with servants and Rolls Royces outside?
I think they have got worse. What used to happen when I was growing up was that the Indians didn't display their wealth, because they had great wealth. Once you entered a house, there were servants, there was always a chauffeur driving people around, so there was no problem of drink driving and things like that. And, you know, and the moment you left your house with a briefcase to go to the office, a servant would come along and carry the briefcase, and a chauffeur would open the door. All that remained, but now the wealth has grown, and a lot more people in India have grown rich. India is still a poor country, and these people now, like the Ambanis, are not afraid to display their wealth. My father used to tell me a story of meeting a businessman in India soon after India got independence. And he went to his house in Mumbai, up in the hills, Malabar Hill. And the house outside was rather decrepit. Inside was wonderfully furnished. And the man said, Bo Sahib, Sahib being a term of respect in India, what can I do? This is an old house. I inherited it from my grandparents. It's been in the family and so on. But I've done the inside up, you know, and I couldn't live in the sort of house that they were living in. And my father then discovered that actually he was a nouveau riche. He had recently made money, bought the house, but wanted to pretend that he was part of the historic landed gentry rich of India. That had changed. Now you find Indians very keen to advertise their wealth in a way that they weren't doing it when I was growing up.
Yes, and the wealth doesn't spread as much as it should. But we're going to talk about that a little later, because you did write a book on current India. And before I ask the next question to you, I want to ask our wonderful audience and people in the room here, ask Mihir Bose anything, because that is a goals to rule. He will try to answer the question. And the only stupid question is the one you never ask. So if you want to ask anything about India, anything about sport, anything about living in Shepherd's Bush, just put it in the comments and the chat, and we will go through it. After Mr. Crombie, you dedicate your book to Father Fritz. Who is he?
Father Fritz, I went to a Jesuit school, though I'm not a Jesuit, but the Jesuits had a lot of students of all faiths, Hindus, Muslims, Parsis, and so on. And Father Fritz took us for English and took us for sport. And it was Father Fritz who made me believe I could be a writer. I had to do an essay on a poem by Shelley, the great poem Ozymandias, you know, about...
Ozymandias, yes, rising from the... Yeah.
But what I wrote about it, and Fritz said to me, you will be a writer. And those words meant a lot to me. You know, he gave me the confidence to believe that I could write, and that was important, and you know, that I carried with me in the years when I didn't think I could be a writer, and my great ambition was to write a novel and, you know, win the Booker Prize. And I haven't written a novel. I'm still waiting to win the Booker Prize. But Fritz carried me through, and I'm grateful to him for the way he taught us, for the way he made us believe that we could compete with the best in the world.
Who is the greatest Indian novelist?
For my money, I would say one of the greatest novelists, though he was not born in India, is V.S. Naipaul. But he, okay, was actually from Trinidad, but I would say he's one of the greatest novelists I've read. But I admired English novelists. I was brought up to admire people like Somerset Maugham and so on, though I came to this country and I found that nobody likes Somerset Maugham.
So if anybody, we'll have one of our random guesses sing. If anybody wants to say who is the greatest novelist, who is the greatest Indian novelist, put it in the chat and we will get Mihir to comment on it. Because writing, you did your engineering, you did your accountancy, but writing was where your heart was. Is that right? And absolutely, you followed that dream.
Absolutely. And as you know, Humphrey, in India, there are these... street bookstores, and I had picked up a book by James Cameron, which was called What a Way to Run a Tribe. And this was his collection of journalistic pieces he had written. And when I read it, I couldn't believe that any journalist, anybody could write like that. You know, for me, it was a revelation. I wanted to write like that. I wanted to write a book which have by collected journalism. And then I also discovered, because in India, there aren't many libraries, and the British Council Library was highly rated. It was so popular, You had to be 16 before you could become a member of the British Council Library. But I discovered opposite our house, this Downton Abbey-style house that we had, was the British Deputy High Commissioner. And that had a little library that I could go in. And there I read British newspapers, like the New Statesman, Anthony Howard writing there. And I read the Times, the Guardian, and all the other papers. And in those days, the tabloid papers hadn't come along, apart from the Daily Mirror. The Sun hadn't been invented. And the Daily Mail, the Daily Express were all broadsheets. And I would read it. And the way it was written was totally different. I mean, I was reading English newspapers in India, the Times of India. It was totally different to anything I read in the Times of India. And I thought this prose is so marvelous, you know. This is what I want to emulate. This is what I want to copy. And it was also nice. I'd go there at lunchtime, and at lunchtime the ladies who worked at the British Deputy High Commissioner would all go off to have lunch, and they were wearing shorter skirts than anything I'd seen in India. So, you know, another added pleasure, if you like.
That was insane. So you're here in the 70s in Britain, where we went through, I'm just trying to, you know, you've got the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, you've got the Winter of Discontent, you've got all of this stuff going on, and you land in the middle of all that. How was it?
I actually landed a few months after Enoch Powell's Rivers of Blood speech, and what I was aware that there would be, you know, because I'd read about the speech and what it said and that immigration was a problem. But what I didn't anticipate was that my color would immediately make me identifiable as somebody different. And I only realized that not at university at Loughborough, where within 6 weeks I got elected president of the union, amazingly, and one of the women students said, I voted for you because you have a face that is trustworthy. You won't run away with the union's funds. I don't know what funds the union had. But anyway, when I came to London, which was a city of my dreams, I would go around on the Circle Line looking at all the stations, Mansion House, and, you know, and Bank, and say, my God, the names are so wonderful. And I suddenly found that I encountered firsthand racism of the type that I didn't expect to encounter. For instance, when I started looking for accommodation, this is when I was a student accountant, I would ring up a landlady, and she would say, oh, yes, we come and have a look. We've got a bedsit for you. And these were ads in the Times. The Times had a student edition, or student copy that was available cheaper than the main paper. And when I went there, they said, no, it's just gone. And eventually I told one of the landladies after she said, oh, come and have a look. This was a bedsit in Hampstead. And I said, but, you know, I'm an Indian. And there was a pause. And then she said, no, my husband wouldn't like an Indian in the house. So, you know, it was a bit of a shock, because I'd assumed I was coming back to the country of look back in anger, and Kenneth Tynan and Anthony Howard and Somerset Maugham and so on. And, you know, I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to be part of that crowd. And suddenly I found that that world wasn't quite the world I'd imagined. Because for us, though, India had won freedom and we were Midnight's children, we were very proud of that. We saw Britain as providing the final endorsement of anything we did. If Britain said so, then that really meant that we had arrived.
That's interesting. Carolyn asks, which part of London did you move to when leaving Mumbai? Where did you end up?
I actually got a place in Earl's Court. But actually, I spent far too much money there, and my bank said, we are not honoring your checks, and I realized I was in an overdraft situation, so I had to hurry up to Clapham, which in those days wasn't quite the upmarket place it had become. It was quite downmarket, and, you know, I got a cheap bedsit. And the woman there was into Egyptian history, and she didn't mind me. In fact, she quite liked borrowing my copy of the New Statesman and telling me about all the Egyptian pharaohs and so on and so forth.
And so you went from Earl's Court, which is quite pricey, down to Clapham. Now you've gone up again in the world to Shepherd's Bush.
Yes, and this is in fact a bit of a diary. I used to live in near St. John's Wood, about 2 minutes from Lourdes. But then I got married to my wonderful wife Caroline, and she has a house in Shepherd's Bush. So I gave up my flat in St. John's Wood and moved to this three-storied house. You know, and I'm on the top of it now talking to you. And Shepherd's Bush also used to be very working class, but I think it's coming up in the world, not because I'm here, but you know, I think generally, it's coming up in the world.
Oh, it. You and Grant asks, so you're talking about your experiences coming in here. Coming in the early to mid-70s, did you suffer any prejudice as a result of the arrival of the Ugandan Asians expelled by Idi Amin, which was a huge issue at the time? Remember that?
Yes, I do. In fact, I suffered a fairly difficult moment, very threatening moment when I became a football correspondent for the Sunday Times. But in the 70s, actually, the Ugandan Asians changed the face of Asian immigration in this country, because before that, the Asian immigrants who had come from India and Pakistan had come from the rural areas of India and Pakistan, like Mirpur, which is Pakistan, Kashmir, or Punjab and so on. The Ugandan Asians brought enterprise, and suddenly Indian shops emerged, you know, and chemists and so on, and that changed the picture. In Indians were no longer people who were working in factories. They were shop owners and businessmen, and they made a big contribution. Now, at that stage, there wasn't that discrimination. Before that, I would say in the late 60s, early 70s, there was more.
Mm-hmm. So you're right, because it was that Ugandan immigration issue there that brought us the corner shop that would be open at all hours of night and at weekends, whereas before it was 9 to 5, and of course they always closed for lunch, didn't they, before that? let's get back to your growing up. When you said you wanted to be a writer, you always wanted to write about sport?
No, I wanted to write about everything, but sport was a subject that obviously interested me. I played a bit of sport at school, not very well. I went to school actually with a very famous cricketer who was 2 years my junior, Sunil Gavaskar, a remarkable cricketer. And I started reading the newspaper from the back, in the sports pages at the back. But it's just that I found it sort of, because I followed sport, I found it easy to write on sport and things like that. And I read a lot of books on sport because I was interested in cricket. My cousins presented me books on cricket written by famous English cricketers, Tom Graveney's book, Jim Laker's book, and so on. I didn't realize then that they hadn't actually written the book. They were ghosted and ghost-written books, that I discovered many years later. But I loved reading them. And I just found watching a game, whether it be cricket or football, I could sort of translate it into words about how I felt about it.
And I think, am I right in saying that cricket is an Indian obsessed sport, as football is a British one? Is that?
Yeah, absolutely. But we did follow football. In fact, I became a Tottenham Hotspur supporter because Tottenham Hotspur won the double in 1961, and the Times of India led its back page with the Tottenham team taking the trophy, the league and the FA Cup trophy, through the on a double-decker bus, which I was familiar with because London buses used to be sold to India. And you know, the picture was so enchanting. I said, this is my team. So I used to follow it. And then, of course, I would sit up late at night to listen to the BBC World Service news and give the sports results on a Saturday. And though I, you know, obviously the Tottenham result fascinated me, but also another result fascinated me of a team called Queen of the South in Scotland. And I wondered if the Queen actually sat in the stadium watching the match. And years later, when Queen of the South got to the Scottish Cup final, which was a first for them, I persuaded the Today programme for me to go there and do a programme. And they said, we are the only team in the Bible because Queen Sheba is mentioned in the Bible.
Oh my goodness. Let us, because we left you on your trajectory, your sporting career at LBC, just foot in the door there, but recognized as that. What happened after that, and where did you want to end up as a sports writer once you had broken that ceiling.
I wanted to write for the great papers, the Sunday Times and people like that, because I'd grown up reading Brian Glanville and John Oliver. And in fact, my great ambition was to be the Guardian's cricket correspondent, because in our school, essays, one of our books of essays was an essay by Neville Cardus on Ranjit Singhji, who he said had never played a Christian stroke in his life. It was an Indian prince who came here and absolutely was one of the greats of cricket. And he'd written this article describing Ranji playing at Sussex and Yorkshire coming to Sussex and so on. That picture he drew of Sussex at and the Hove ground and the sea breeze coming in and so on. And I wanted to be like that, to, you know, be the Guardian's cricket correspondent. In fact, apart from a couple of articles, I've never written cricket for the Guardian. But that's what I wanted to be. Those were my heroes I wanted to emulate. And you know, I read their writings, read their books, collected their books. And I had the pleasure of meeting Neville Cardus a week before he sadly died.
And give us a situation. We're still in the late 70s now, let's say. What was the situation, one with sports reporting and the sort of money that was in sport and the prominence in our lives?
Sport hadn't become that prominent in our lives. When I started writing for the Sunday Times, the Sunday Times had four pages of sport at the back of the paper. They had a separate business section, but not a separate sports section. That came much later. And sport wasn't something that was featured on the front pages. And the money that came into sport was still money that the punters paid at the gates through the turnstiles. Commercial money hadn't started coming in. That only started coming in the late 70s and early 80s. And it's worth remembering, Humphrey, at that stage, though cricket was televised by the BBC in the summer on BBC One, all the test matches, and there was no Sunday play was looked down on because there was the Lord's Day Observance Society's views on Sunday play. And football, the only football match that was televised live was the FA Cup final, which was televised both on BBC and ITV. And the joke was that more people watched it on BBC because they thought the BBC product was the genuine one, whereas the ITV one was the fake one. But anyway, that was just a joke. So there was no live televised matches shown of league football. The league wouldn't allow it, and you would get only the highlight, the match of the day, and so on. So in a way, and of course, even with the reporting of football matches, because it was only four pages, Brian Glanville, the legendary football correspondent of the Sunday Times, got 500 words. And those of us who reported not the big matches got about 250 to 300 words. So, you know, it wasn't the sort of extensive coverage that you now find, you know, where a whole page could be devoted to a football match report.
Well, when did that change?
That began to change really in the late 80s and early 90s, which is when money really started coming into football, when television money started coming in, sponsorship money coming in. And what has happened now is that, frankly, the fans, the spectators, are really not that important. Their money is only a small proportion of the club's income. Now the clubs are sponsored. Now the clubs get enormous amount of money, billions from television. Now airline companies like Qatar and others sponsor a particular club, you know, and players carry the names of the sponsors on their shirts, which was just wasn't there. And, you know, so therefore, the money that has come in is largely a phenomenon of the last, I would say, 15 to 20 years.
And was that money coming into football and cricket, was tennis and other things like that? Did it flow into sport generally?
Yeah, in fact, funnily enough, it was tennis which first opened up in the 60s, which brought money in. Golf brought in a money in, individual sport. But team sport, curiously, it was cricket that started it, because a man called Kerry Packer tried to hijack cricket. And the cricket authorities found that suddenly here was a man of money, a very rich businessman, trying to take away their best players. Then they started getting sponsorship, and Cornhill became the first insurance company to sponsor cricket. And it's a very interesting story. I was at the Sunday Times then, and the Sunday Times sports editor said, "Why should we call it the Cornhill Test? Cricket has been going for 100 years. Who are Cornhill?" And Cornhill, in order to make sure that the cricket journalists would name the test matches, the Cornhill Test, employed a former cricket correspondent to go around at lunchtime offering us wine and lunch, and then saying, as he poured the wine into our glass, "Listen, lads, tomorrow's test is the Cornhill Test." It's an interesting story here. John Arlott, the great correspondent of Guardian and Test Match Special, he said to this correspondent, he said, "Chalky," his name was Crawford White, "Chalky, I want another bottle of wine." And Chalky said to Arlo, "You've had one bottle of wine. You've got to do Test Match Special on BBC. You've got to write your Guardian piece. Go easy on it." And Arlo said, "Chalky, if I don't get another bottle of wine, tomorrow's test match is the Prudential Test match." He didn't get a bottle of wine. He quoted the Prudential Test match. And of course, Arlott's copy was never changed by the Guardian. So the next day, it became the Prudential Test match. That shows money was coming in, but not vast quantities. But the newspaper editors were very reluctant to publicize it. Now, of course, that would be a totally different story.
You've written a number of books on this, I want to talk about it. One of them was called sometime Corruption, Manchester Disunited and the Business of Soccer. Mm. You've also written about India taking over the world of cricket. We've talked about the money coming in, then how is it used?
Well, what has happened is that this money has largely gone to the top players. Their wages have increased, and it's worth recalling, until the 60s, we had in football what was called wage slavery. The maximum wage was £10. And Tommy Trinder, who the comic artist and performer who owned Fulham, made a promise that he would make the first player a £100 player, Johnny Haynes. And, you know, that was a big thing, £100 a week player. But now that money has gone in lot into players. And Alan Sugar has called it what is known as Carlos Kickerball. Carlos is a foreign player who's brought in to play for England. And the first thing he says when he's offered money is this netto? Is this net of tax or is this gross? And, you know, and that's where it has gone in. It hasn't really gone into grassroots football. In fact, what has happened is English football used to be democratic in a way that transfer money and the money that came would go down to the lower leagues and would sustain the teams in the third, second and third and fourth division. But that has dried up. Those clubs struggle, whereas the top clubs get all the cream.
And you mentioned in that book corruption. Is there a lot of corruption generally in sport?
There used to be, there still is. What used to happen is, this is the great bung story, which I was fortunate enough to break for the Sunday Times all those years ago. What used to happen is that when a manager agreed to sell a player to another manager in another club, and he would ask for a bung. In other words, he would ask for a cash payment. Remember, in those days, managers didn't get paid a lot of money. So the fee for the player, let's say, was 1 million, and the manager would say, "Well, I want £50,000 in addition in cash." And this was the famous story when Terry Venables, buying Teddy Sheringham from Nottingham Forest for Tottenham Hotspur, told Alan Sugar that Brian Clough, who was the manager of Nottingham Forest, wants a bung, which absolutely outraged Sugar. And he also told him that Cluffy likes a bung in a motorway cafe, you know, and paid in crisp notes stuffed in an envelope. And Cluffy did get the bung, and there was an inquiry and all that. We did that story years ago in the Sunday Times, and that's when it came out. And really, football then was quite corrupt. And they used to have what was called the chairman's turnstile. One of the turnstiles, the cash collected from that was reserved for the chairman, so he had cash money to pay the players. Because of all the restrictions on how much you could pay players and so on, they paid some of the money in cash. And so it was very much a cash economy.
So I just want to go back to something that struck me. You said the low pay for the players of £10 a week. So when England won the World Cup in 1965, those players were getting paid what?
Those players would have been getting paid at the most £100 a week, £110 a week, and things like that. They wouldn't be getting a lot of money. They would be considered serfs. And also, I mean, the £10 a week had by then gone because the players had gone on a strike and there'd been a big campaign. But there was another restriction that players have contracts with the club. The club, if they, the player can't move from one club to the other without the club willing to sell. But at that stage, the contracts had another restriction that even when the player came to the end of his contract, he couldn't move to another club unless that the club that he was playing for had got a certain sum of money. So if you like, he was bound to the club in the most absurd, if you like, in a sort of slave-like situation, if one can call it that, a model slave-like situation.
It sounds a bit like bonded labor, which is so common in your homeland. Sue Townley asks, did you ever meet Henry Blofeld?
Of course. I knew Henry very well.
Henry has been on Goals to Shows. Just give Sue a line on what Henry's like.
Yeah. Well, Henry had this wonderful turn of phrase. You see, he could convey this picture. He didn't have Orloff's imagery, but he had this feeling that he made you feel that you were part of him, you know, and then he would suddenly say things like, oh, the number 36 is going down Harlesford Road, when he was commenting at the Oval and things like that. So, you know, Henry was, though he was very upper class and so on and so forth, public school educated, but actually when you met him, he had a great deal of charm. And of course, Henry was famous for his, shall we say, his many affairs. And, you know, you always, it's me meeting people who knew Henry and you know, had gone out with Henry.
Yes, I met him in Australia many years ago, and he was very kind to me because, like you, I was saying, I was just beginning in journalism, and he introduced me to the sports editor of The Age and other people like that. But I wasn't writing sports, so that was but it gave me an insight into that. India and cricket. India has taken over cricket, you say?
Yes, India is a very interesting country. India is actually a sporting midget. India is the most populous country in the world. It has overtaken China. But if you look at its sporting achievements, apart from hockey, where India was very dominant between the 1920s and the 1960s, winning every Olympic gold and so on, India hasn't performed well on the international sports stage. Cricket became a big sport in India. The British, of course, brought cricket to India because the Maharajas, under British rule, took up cricket. They saw this as trying to gain influence with the British. The British, incidentally, played in India. They called themselves Europeans, and they had a team called Europeans, which were people of pure European blood who could play. But cricket took off. The Maharajas cultivated it, you know, and initially in Indian cricket, you had to be a Maharaja to be captain, even if you couldn't play cricket. And there was one prince who passed himself off as a prince who was popularly known as Vizzy, who actually managed to become captain of India, who was really like an Indian Billy Bunter. And when he captained, he came on the 1936 tour with 36 items of luggage and two servants, and his test match average was 8.25, which is slightly lower than my average playing club cricket. But and that, if you like, that aura of cricket being a sport played by the well-off remained. When India became independent, the various companies started employing cricketers, and they used cricket to promote themselves. So you had tournaments where companies had their own cricket team. You know, imagine,
Esso cricket, Tesco cricket.
And they would play against each other. They saw that as advertisement. And because test match cricket, and that test match cricket was the only form of cricket available then, is a five-day game, they saw it as a big advertisement for the game. And that is how, but what has taken Indian cricket to another level is the arrival of television. Television came late to India. I grew up without having seen a single moment of television. I only saw television in this country when I came here in 1969 at the age of 21. And when television arrived, the number of outlets increased enormously. By then, India had also acquired a middle class. 10% of Indians are quite well off. They have an income comparable to the income in the West. And they started following cricket. And the Indians discovered that what you need is to attract women to cricket, to watch cricket, because the The television controls are controlled by the Indian housewife at home. So then they started devising a product, and the one they have devised is extremely popular, called the Indian Premier League, which is played in the evening in the summer. When I was growing up, the idea of playing in the heat of May, and you can't imagine what the heat of May is like, Humphrey, I won't have to tell you, but those who've never been to India don't know how intensely hot it is. It's nothing that you've experienced in this country ever. But what the Indians devised was a game that started not in the morning at 10 o'clock, but started at 7 or 8 o'clock in the evening. By then, you know, it was quite cool and went on till 11 o'clock. So, in effect, it became like a sitcom. You had Bollywood movies to entertain you, and you had cricket to entertain you. And that is where the money has come in. India can now provide the sort of money no other a cricket nation can. India has a huge population, and India is doing well in cricket. Indians can feel that as a cricketing nation, we are competing against the best. We're not competing in football or other sports, but we're competing in cricket.
And what influence or interference would all that money from one nation have on the sport generally?
It has completely changed the sport. When I was growing up, when the English cricket season started, at the end of April, cricket rest of the world stopped. Everybody from the world, the best players, wanted to come and play in England. In the early days, they played in the Lancashire Leagues, in places like Haslingden and so on. But then after county cricket opened up in the 60s, they played for county cricket. So Imran Khan came and played here. And whether in bowling for Worcester he learned his politics or not is a different matter. But anyway, he was a big player here. And many others came and played. The Nawab of Pathodi, who captained India, came and played and so on. He also played for Winchester. But the point is, that has completely changed. Now, English players, and this is something I would never have dreamt of, actually miss part of their cricket season to go and play in IPL, because IPL starts just as the English cricket season is starting. It cuts the English cricket season, and the England Cricket Board allow these players to go because they can earn for about 6 weeks of cricket and playing 20 T20 matches, which is 20 over matches. So there's not a great deal of physical effort required. It's not a 5-day test. They can earn a couple of £100,000 pounds, which is the sort of money footballers earn.
Yes.
Therefore, they can become immensely rich.
And that immensely rich, but they're not here to play the county cricket that they sort of meant to play or whatever.
They're not here to play county cricket. They make arrangements with the ECB. They might even miss a test match, which is absolutely unheard of. And cricket in the West Indies has declined. I grew up with great West Indian team because they don't have the money. Cricket, to a certain extent, in Pakistan, for various reasons, India-Pakistan relationship has affected that, doesn't have the sort of drawing power that the Indians have. And Indians now provide more than 80% of world cricket's income because Indian companies have seen cricket as a way of advertising their product. And
which is how it began, you said, with the whole thing. And I just wanted, and Ewan Grant has said that he has not heard such a succinct and forensic description of what has changed in football and sport generally. That's your succinctness and your descriptive powers there, Mahir. I just wonder, before I want to move back to India's society in a moment, but a couple of issues that have come up. The World Cup going to Saudi Arabia, which has been a story in the past week. Talk us around that.
Yeah, and this is the power of sport. Sport, as I said, was not a big thing. When England won the World Cup, the Soccer World Cup, Football World Cup in 66, believe it or not, Brian James, who was at the Daily Mail, told me the story. He was given 250 words to write about the victory. And, it just barely made the front page. Now, if England should win the World Cup, and I hope England wins the World Cup, there'll be special supplements about it. There'll be tons of material, coverage on radio and television and so on, end-to-end stuff. I think what people have realized is the power of sport as a soft power. That is something that nations have realized. And nations like Saudi Arabia are using that to promote themselves. I mean, who would have thought of Saudi Arabia? No, nobody would really be discussing Saudi Arabia except perhaps for its autocratic regimes and what it does to people who it feels are violating the laws of Islam and so on and so forth. But suddenly, footballers are earning huge sums of money going and playing in Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia is being spoken of, if you like, as a country of note in a way that it never was before it started investing in sport.
And also we had Qatar, what was it last time? What is it significant? Is it politics and sport integrating like this? Is it is it the right thing to do, Mahir?
I think there are dangers. What happened was when sport started emerging as a world phenomenon in the 30s, the only people who understood the power of sports were the dictators. Mussolini was the first. Mussolini actually promoted Italian football, and Italy won the World Cup twice before the war. But Britain, people in this country never saw sport in that way. Yes, there would be sporting references and things like that, you know, and you know, observations. But this country never used sport. There was talk when they had the empire of using sport as a civilizing mission, but sport was not something that was in the front page, was not something that politicians talked about at one stage when, after the First World War, there was talk about Britain taking part in the Olympics. Winston Churchill said, no, the government is not going to provide money for that. And even for the London Olympics in 2012, I was at the Telegraph. The Telegraph sports editor then was very keen on the Olympics. And he said, Mihir, you must lead the campaign in the paper to try and get the Olympics. And the government was very reluctant. Gordon Brown, the Chancellor, wasn't interested in the Olympics. He wanted to bring the World Cup. And it was actually Tony Blair's wife, Cherie Blair, was very interested. I met her at the Reform Club. She came for a cup of tea, and she wanted to know what the Olympics was all about and what it would mean for her to be the leader of the bid. And this was a very sort of, you know, off-the-record private meeting. And in the end, she didn't become bid leader. But it took a lot of persuasion for the government to accept that Britain should bid for the Olympics, and that bidding for the Olympics, and Britain, remember, beat Paris, beat Madrid, beat Moscow, New York, that it would be a great moment. And it had it proved to be a great moment. It brought the country together. It advertised the country. And I think what it shows is that sport can be used without raising wider issues. Now, Saudi Arabia is different. Because of the nature of the country, Qatar is different. Because of the way it treats migrant labor, it raises the question of whether such a country should be allowed by sport to advertise itself in a different form. And that is our perception of what is good or bad has changed. When South Africa had apartheid, a lot of people accepted that.
I was about to say that, yes.
South Africa played sport for a long time. Rugby never cut its ties with South Africa. Individual South Africans, tennis players and golfers were never excluded from tennis or golf. But we now feel that if something that is unequal, something that is discriminatory, we should not allow that. Our sense of what is right and wrong, if you like, has changed.
Yes, that is fascinating. And I just wanted to go back to Mr. Crombie in India in a way, because your knowledge of sport, as we've seen from Ewan Grant, is absolutely incredible. You have some telling phrases in there. One of them, when you talk about we had to demonstrate that India wasn't a country which had been held together only because of the British nanny, that India had been a country long before the British arrived. What did you mean by that?
One of the things the British said to justify their rule was that there was no country called India, that we had made India. So when the Indian nationalists, the freedom fighters, said, we want freedom for India, they said, what India are you talking about? We the British, have created India. So when in 1917, the war cabinet under Lloyd George met to discuss what they could do, because by then the white colonies had been given a dominion status and basically made free countries, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and Canada. And they said, and in fact, the war cabinet minutes show that the cabinet agreed that it would take the Indians 500 years to learn how to rule themselves. So, you know, it was a very slow process. And that's how it was felt. So this was, if you like, the British answer to the Indians saying, you conquered our country, we want freedom. And they were saying, no, you didn't have a country. We made your country. There's no India. So we had to demonstrate that there was an India, the India that went back to the days of Ashoka and the Guptas and the Mughals and so on and so forth. And, you know, so there was a lot of stress that, yes, the British ruled India, but there was always an India. And in fact, the British actually didn't rule all of India. A third of India was ruled by the princess, whom their dominion had complete internal control.
And of course, in that early India, Burma or Myanmar was part of India, and Pakistan was part of it, and then going right up there. I'm going to come back to you with a question on that after I've asked you this next question before we go to the promotions. You ask also, who are you? It resonates with me because it raises the profoundly serious question of my own identity. You've taken us through that, Mahir. So who are you?
Well, you see, when I grew up in India, because we wanted to stress there was always an India, we were discouraged from saying what our religion was, because that would suggest religious strife. So you were called a communalist, which meant the Indians use the word communalist as meaning a religious bigot. So, you know, you couldn't say you were a Hindu or a Muslim or a Parsi or Catholic or whatever, or Christian. And that was one thing. The other thing is you were discouraged from saying which part of India you came from, whether you came from Bengal, and my family originally came from Bengal, though I grew up in Mumbai in the West. So because that meant that you were questioning the identity of India. You were actually giving in to the British saying, we made India. So when after living here now, I'm now satisfied that I'm a person of Indian origin, who is a Hindu, though I don't have a religion. And anyway, Hinduism is not a religion, it's a cuisine. It provides the best food before prayers or after prayers. But the point is that I don't mind admitting it. I'm not ashamed of admitting it, because I feel that has established my identity. I am who I am, but I'm very happy to live in this country where the vast majority of people are neither Indians nor Hindus, because of the opportunities it has provided me to fulfill my dream of becoming a journalist.
I see. So can I call you a Shepherd's Bushite? Would that be offensive?
No, not at all. No, I'd be very happy.
A patriotic Shepherd's Bush. Emma says, it is interesting to listen to you talk about colonization attitude in India, because it brings to light the same attitude that prevailed in Zimbabwe when it was still Rhodesia. Emma comes from Zimbabwe. Does that resonate with you?
Yes, and I mean, Zimbabwe was an interesting country to visit, because I was sent there after there was problems because of Mugabe's regime and what Mugabe had done, problems with the Zimbabwe cricket team. When I got there, they said, you have entered on false pretenses. I hadn't entered, because with the British passport you could enter. And they confined me to my hotel for a night, took away my passport, and then deported me. So I was very glad, if you like, to leave Mugabe's Zimbabwe. But I can understand, yes. I think people misunderstand colonialism. I think people talk about the wealth taken. No, I think the colonial thing was that it made the people who were colonized feel that they were not quite up to it, that they were inferior, that they had to look up to a superpower, a supreme power, and get its approval and verdict. And that was the basic thing of colonialism. Because there have been empires, you know, empires have looted other countries. You know, the colonial empires were not different in that sense. It was this feeling that if you wanted to believe that what you had done was really right, you had to get the approval of the British. And when I was growing up in India, my friends and I would read the British papers and then show off our knowledge to other people in our school, whose English was not that good, or whose knowledge of Britain was not that good, to show that we were really superior and we were the chosen ones.
How interesting. I'm going to pause it there. Emma, if you've got a thought on that, put it in the chat, because that's a fascinating thing about, do you need to have this higher values or whatever. That. But coming up, we have December the 23rd, which is Christmas Eve, and we have no show. So that's a false promotion I gave you there. December the 31st, on New Year's Eve, Lucinda has got her party dress on for Claire McIntosh's The Last Party, a village murder mystery that takes place, oh yes, you guessed it, on New Year's Eve. January the 7th, I'm with Kim Leng Ling, who's an expert on the transformative power of kindness and how pets make us better people. So we'll want to hear your kindness stories and pet stories. January the 14th, I have the great Craig Brown with his latest much acclaimed A Voyage Around the Queen, which is a deep insight into Queen Elizabeth, the late Queen Elizabeth. And Craig has also written hilariously about Princess Margaret and the Beatles. So that is on January the 14th at 1 o'clock. Do we have a message coming in? Yes, we do. I just wanted to get back to Emma. I would like to describe, I like how you describe yourself, because I too am proud to be an African woman by descent, and that is very much grounded in me no matter where I settle. I like people who accept who they are. You accept who you are, Mahir.
I do indeed.
But any regrets or pats on the back from becoming a celebrated sports writer and author and not an accountant and engineer?
No, not at all, except I would have loved to have been a great cricketer and scored a century at Lord's, but there we are.
Still time. We'll have the Goldster one day at Lord's for anybody over 55 that can do it. But we are out of time. The final whistle has been blown. And what a brilliant show. Thank you, Mahir. Thank you for all your questions. Thank you, Emma. Until our book club on New Year's Eve with Lucinda, stay sporting, stay curious, be general, be active, socialize, and of course, stay Goldster. Tell all your friends and family about us. And for the Goldster podcast, where Mahir will be in a couple of weeks, you only have to Google Goldster podcast. An array of fascinating conversations will unfold. The magnificent Eva Hamilton from last week, I think, has just been published there. Mahir Bose, thank you so much.
Oh, wow.
It's really good. Enjoy the rest of your day in Shepherd's Bush.
Very much, Humphrey.
Thank you. Brilliant. You lifted my spirit and you put my learning curve up. So on that note, bye, Mahir, and bye, everybody.
You've been listening to a Goldster Magazine Show podcast. Check us out on www.goldster.co.uk. We hope to tempt you, your family, and friends into the exciting world of helping everyone live healthier and happier for longer. Find more podcasts just by Googling Goldster and podcast. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, and hope you're with us again soon.